ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Sleep is something we love to stress over. Did I sleep long enough? Was it good enough quality? Why on earth do those cockatoos have to screech so loudly right on sunrise? Now, a new thing to stress about, getting less sleep in midlife can actually shorten your career. So what can you actually do about it? Not many of us are out here actively trying to sleep worse. Well, that's in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, who doesn't love a good whinge? It's arguably part of our culture. But the face of whinging has shifted over the generations. I'll get into that with our resident sociologist soon. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, home ownership remains out of reach for a huge swathe of Australians, which means in turn, more people are renting long term. So what can we do to make life as a renter a bit closer to the Australian dream? Well, the Australian Council of Trade Unions has taken its wish list to the government, proposing increased investment in public housing, but also some stronger rights for tenants, including minimum two-year lease terms, stronger regulatory powers to enforce the rules, more protections against unfair evictions and rent gouging. And they say these measures would go a long way to giving tenants a sense of stability and a capacity to plan for their future. So if we're rethinking renting, what else should be on the table? And with me are two lifelong renters. Simone is in her 50s, living on the New South Wales South Coast. Candy is in her 80s, renting in regional Victoria. Welcome to both of you. Candy, I might start with you. How long have you been renting for?
Actually, all of my adult life.
So that's a while, respectfully.
A long, long time.
How have you found it over those years?
Well, it actually didn't used to be so bad. You were able to find a place to rent, and the rent was quite reasonable, and the houses weren't terribly brilliant, but they actually were secure. They were safe. You had a lease that was ongoing, so it was okay. I retired about 10 years ago, and for about the first couple of years, it was not too bad. And then since COVID, it's just become ridiculous. It's so hard to rent a place. The rents are so high and I'm on an age pension, so I don't have a lot of excess money. All of my savings has gone because I have, you know, had to meet the rents. But the problem was landlords can get more rent from people who are earning more money. So consequently, I've had to move, you know, roughly every year or 18 months, which has meant that I'm, you know, like I say, in my early 80s and still have no really secure place to live.
That sounds really, really hard, Candy. Simone, how's your experience been as a renter?
I really empathise with Candy, Tegan. My story's very similar to hers. I've been on a Centrelink benefit because I've been studying for the last few years, and there is no security. You know, you are pushed to the back of the list due to higher rents. And again, like Candy, I'm a lifelong renter, and you did used to be able to get a house, a roof over your head. It just seems to be getting harder and harder. And I'm not really sure, you know, what the solution is, but I'd like if we could find one.
Yeah, so this idea of a minimum two-year lease, well, as a standard, a two-year lease as a standard. Candy, do you think that would make a difference to you?
I do. I don't understand why we don't have 10-year leases. You know, in the UK, people do have, and that's where I'm from originally, they do have, you know, lifelong leases. And I know people in Melbourne who had a 25-year lease, or they lived in one house for 25 years. I just don't understand why we don't have longer leases, so that people can just feel more secure. Because, you know, I brought my children up in rental properties, and we were constantly having to move. In their high school, that we might have moved 7 times, which is not fair. Mm. It's totally not fair. It's also, it's not healthy. It's not healthy for older people to constantly have to move, because it's financially draining, it's emotionally draining, it's psychologically draining. It's just a terrible situation to be in. However, there must be a reason that people are making so much money out of us tenants.
Simone, what would be on your wish list as a renter? Is it the 2-year lease, or would there be something different for you?
Well, Tegan, I've been stable in my current rental for a year and a half, but in that time I've had a rent increase every 6 months. So I don't know whether that would benefit me, because I don't know if that means I would be locked in, you know. So if I found something more affordable, I might not be able to move to it.
Mm. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Simone and Candy, both lifelong renters, about what it's been like as renters, the amount of times they've had to move, rent increases, difficulty getting leases as rents get more expensive. And Candy in particular says since moving on to an aged care pension around the time of COVID, it's been particularly hard. I'm wondering what your experience has been as a renter, what you would change if you were designing rental policy in Australia. Genevieve says renters need long-term tenure, rent caps, and decent maintenance and repairs. Another says security of tenure, being able to stay long-term in a place that works for you, more social housing or rent tied to a percentage of your income. Well, also here with us is Hal Pawson, Emeritus Professor of Housing Research and Policy at the University of New South Wales. Hal's also the Associate Director of the City Futures Research Centre. Hal, listening to Candy and Simone, listening to those texts, do those chime for you in your research?
Yeah, they really do. I mean, it's definitely true that Australia has relatively little security for private tenants compared with, well, with not with every country, but with some, certainly with some European countries. In Germany or Switzerland, Austria, for example, you could expect to really remain in a private rental property for as long as you wish. And we've moved a little bit closer to that over the last few years. So I think credit to the state and territory governments and the federal government, who have pushed things a little bit towards something slightly more secure in the last 5 years or so. And that's in changes that have been made to Residential Tenancies Acts, where a landlord is no longer allowed to simply end your tenancy at will. Landlords have to give a reason if they want to end a tenancy when it's past its fixed term, and that that's only allowable if the reasons are the specified permitted reasons, and those are if the landlord needs the home for their own use, they need to live in it themselves. Or they want to sell it and they think that they'll maybe get a better price for it if they evict the tenant first. So we have made some moves towards a slightly more secure situation for tenants in the last few years, but there's a lot further that we could go.
So what do you make of this proposal from the ACTU?
It will appeal to some people, of course. But I think for if you're in retirement, for example, 2 years is a lot better than 6 months or 12 months. If you've got no intention of moving, you're hoping to stay there for the rest of your life if you can. But I think for a lot of other people, well, I think in that situation, you still might feel, well, 2 years is it's better than what was previously available. But it's still, you know, it's still, I'd much rather have something that's a lot longer than that. And one of your guests, you know, has made that point. But I think for a lot of other people, there will be some hesitation about a two-year tenancy if it also is binding on the tenants. In other words, you're liable to stay in the property for at least that length of time, or pay some kind of a penalty for leaving early. So, I mean, that isn't really dealt with in the ACTU's proposal. These kind of details are really important to. To clarify before we can really make a decision or decide whether this is something that we should be supporting or saying, well, sounds good in principle, but it perhaps isn't as great as it may appear initially.
One text here, someone from Victoria says, as a landlord, I offer 2-year leases with fixed rental rates if wanted. I make the commitment to lease for this time frame, but my most recent tenants are leaving late November, 3 months early. I have to keep my commitment, but the tenant doesn't have to. How much is the system weighted towards tenants versus landlords, Hal?
Well, I think that the system as a whole is certainly not weighted towards tenants' interests as opposed to landlords. But I think a very big part of the reason for that is the wider balance between supply and demand for rental accommodation, and the fact that we're really living in a landlord's market most of the time. Okay, it wasn't true during COVID, or at least in certain parts of the country. For a short period of time, it was very much a buyer's market. A tenants had, you know, choice of properties, and the market was so hit by the effects of COVID that tenants were able to bid down rental prices really quite substantially in some parts of the country. But that is a really exceptional situation. Most of the time, the landlord's side is advantaged not only by the Residential Tenancy Act regulations, but also by the kind of state of the market and the constant, you know, excessive demand over supply.
Well, Candy, you've had, I mean, more experiences than we can count, but there was one particular experience where you had to move out so the landlord could renovate. What ended up happening in that situation?
Yes, that was this is the whole thing about rules and regulations. They don't often apply. Most times they don't apply. In this situation, the landlord asked me to move out so they could renovate. So, and with the idea that I would go back to the house. I was just staying with friends, waiting. 6 months later, I kept asking, how's it going? When can I move back? They had put somebody else in there without telling me. They doubled the rent. So when that person was in, it was a doctor, when that doctor was in, living in that place for 6 months, they left. And the landlord got back to me and I said, I can't afford that rent. Mm. It's double what I used to pay. So this is the whole thing about rules and regulations. There are ways around them. And a lot of people, you know, they don't really value the tenants they have. A lot of people don't. I'm sure some people do, but that was my experience. It just doesn't work.
Mm. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with lifelong renters Candy and Simone and Emeritus Professor Hal Pawson from UNSW's City Futures Research Centre. We're talking about what would make a difference to stability and long-term well-being for renters. I'd love to know what's on your wish list as a renter. You have so many ideas. You're telling me them on the text line. Dean says, I'm a forever renter. What I want is for my landlord to allow solar panels on the roof, be able to put hooks and paint on the walls, no-fault evictions, 5-year leases with an option for 5 more. Rent capped to 30% of income. Since I can pay rent, I can pay a mortgage, so open up mortgages to those with no deposit. Dean says, I've paid other people's mortgages for 40 years. I'm eager to start paying my own. Kate says, I have moved 16 times in 30 years. I want to have the same laws in New South Wales that are in Victoria, where the property has to meet a minimum standard before it's put on the rental market. The house I currently live in looks great. However, the owner is a builder, so there's massive electrical faults. Every time something goes wrong, he turns up to fix it with his mates, and it's done badly or not done. And one says where it's a house and garden, the owner and not the tenant should be responsible for the upkeep of the garden. They can use some of the rent money to hire someone to at least mow lawns. It's unreasonable to expect tenants to buy mowers and to spend their time with upkeep of a home they'll never own. Hal, there's so many different things coming through there. Can we just talk generally about what sort of... How a tenancy affects renters' stability and well-being broadly?
Yeah, I think also from what your guests have been recounting from their own experience, I think that brings to the fore the fact that there's a very, very wide variety of people who rely on private rental housing in Australia. And I think we should be particularly concerned about the relatively insecure nature of private renting in Australia. We should be particularly concerned about that when it comes to older people, beyond, you know, above working age, and also families, or particularly lone parent families with young children, because those are the kind of population groups who are most vulnerable to the sort of the forced moves that come about because there's a relatively low level of security in private rental housing in Australia. Younger working adults, middle income, even high income people who are living in the private rental market, just for the duration of however long it takes them to save up enough for their home deposit. Yeah, it's inconvenient for them to have to move when the landlord makes a decision and you don't have any say in it. But it's far more damaging and causes far more social dislocation for older people beyond working age and younger vulnerable people who are relying on private rental housing and probably will be there for the rest of their lives. And so it's for those groups that we really need a more secure option. And I think it's not just a question of the rules which govern when landlords can end a tenancy. That's important, and that's what the ACTU's proposal is talking about. But also, in the much more important, in my opinion, in the ACTU's proposals that they published yesterday, is their demand for a much higher level of investment in non-market housing. Public housing is what they're calling for, but I think it could be community housing as well, in my opinion, because that is accommodation. Those are rental tenancies where there's no landlord desire to have the opportunity to end a tenancy at a convenient time for them so that they can sell the property and reap the capital gain, which is the usual motivation of most individual private private landlords operating in Australia. And fair enough, that's an understandable personal motivation, but it doesn't suit it's very badly fitted to the needs of at least some of their tenants, these more vulnerable groups in the population. Mm-hmm. So we need to change the structure of the rental housing market, not just the rules around when landlords can end a tenancy. And what I mean by that is we need a lot more non-market housing rented out to people who qualify on basis of need, and where the rent is is set as a much lower level than the market would demand, and something that's affordable to the tenant. And the other part of the structural change, which I think we should be encouraging, is in a different part of the market. We should also be giving more encouragement to expanding institutionally owned rental property of what sometimes is called build-to-rent housing, which is market. It's priced at a market level, but it's built, commissioned by super funds, insurance companies, financial institutions who want to see a long-term return on capital from tenants' rents. Not being motivated largely by the opportunity to cash in on the capital gain on a property and sell it at the best opportunity. So that's a form of rental housing where the motivation of the landlord is to keep tenants in the property as long as possible and have as few changes of tenancy as possible, because it's all about maximizing the rental income. So those two forms of rental housing, which we have nowhere near enough of in Australia, should be we should have policies and expenditure decisions which are helping to expand those parts of the market.
Well, on the text line, one says, my wish list for renters is more public housing. Simone, you had a taste of that kind of stability for a period. Can you talk to me about what that meant to you?
Well, it was it's hard to put into words how, to not be pushed out and searching for a property is, people say moving stressful, but it's actually the searching for a property. Okay, what can I afford? Now I've got to go to all the inspections, have money for a bond. And so, to have 6 years peace from that was just, and it sounds like such a short time, but it was like, just such a, it just felt such a long period of stability and peace. Like,
was that
it was
the longest
amazing.
You'd spent in a single rental?
Yes.
Yeah, 6 years. At what time of your life was that?
That was as my girls were finishing high school.
What a critical moment that must have been.
It was really, really good for them to have that stability for sure.
And Simone, Candy, you're sort of long to stay long enough in a house that you can actually do what so many people love to do, and that's plant a garden.
Well, that's what I do as a hobby since I've retired, like a lot of old people. What I would really like, what Hal was talking about, sort of social housing, community housing, where you can rent a place, but you can actually stay there. Because I love gardening, and I've grown a tree from a seed, but I keep having to give the trees away because I put them in pots, because I lose the house, I lose the garden. Gardening is so important because it occupies your mind, occupies your body. It's really... it's so healthy. But when I put the seeds in there, in the garden or in the pot, I want to see them grow, and I want to, eat those vegetables, see those herbs, see those flowers, because I do it for everybody who walks past the garden. Mm. But the problem is when you're constantly moving, you're leaving the garden behind, and actually sometimes it improves the property so much that the landlord who's selling it gets more money because it looks so good, And I have done that. I've improved properties so much just by renting them and looking after them and cleaning them and things like that, that they actually are valued higher than what they would have been if it had been in the condition it was when I moved into it. So, I think really good tenants who are genuine should be respected more by anybody who, wants to be a landlord. But I think social housing and community housing that Hal was talking about, long-term, forever, so you can rent your forever home, just be there, clean the place, look after the place, protect the property, and pay your rent quite genuinely, honestly, but you grow your garden because it's good for you and it's good for everybody.
Well, Candy, Simone, I hope you both find the stability you're looking for. Simone and Candy, both lifelong renters. Simone on New South Wales South Coast. Candy also renting in regional Victoria. She's in her early 80s. And thank you, Hal Pawson, Emeritus Professor of Housing Research and Policy, Associate Director at UNSW's City Futures Research Centre. Thank you for your texts as well. So many great different perspectives that you're telling me. One says we need to destigmatise renting. As already mentioned, in Europe, people rent for life and it's not seen to be an issue. We have far too much emphasis here on buying homes. We're consistently told that is the Australian dream. I don't buy it. We have rented the same house in a nice suburb for the past 10 years. We have a wonderful landlord. We've had minimal rent increases. We're good tenants and we look after their home because it is our home. Stop making renters feel like second-class citizens. One from a landlord. We bought an investment property several years ago. It was a new build. We've refused to raise the rent in recent years as we could not justify adding to the problem. It's now 40% below market. Our property manager is not happy with us as it reduces their income. And Arthur in Sydney similarly says, I have a rental property and I think a 2-year lease is very reasonable. I think annual renewals is primarily an income generating process for the agent. One to watch here. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, is your sleep getting worse as you get older? A new study's found that sleep problems in midlife could affect how long you stay in the workforce. When you finally crawled into bed last night, did it take you ages to nod off? Or maybe you woke up at 2 a.m. with your mind racing? Or maybe you share a bed with someone who snores and you can't remember the last time you got a decent night's sleep. Well, as well as being frustrating, a poor night's sleep in midlife could mean an early exit from the workforce. Researchers in Finland studied the sleep habits of people over 50, and they found that disrupted sleep could mean a shorter working life. And it's thought to be the first study that's looked at this connection between midlife sleep and how long people remain in the workforce. So let's talk about what you can do about it. But tell me, I'd love to know if your sleep has changed after 50. What is keeping you up at night? How is it affecting your life? And here with me is Dr. Moira Junger, health psychologist and chief health officer at the Sleep Health Foundation. Moira, welcome back to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan. Good to speak to you again.
So this study's looked at the sleep health of people over 50. What did it find?
Yeah, well, it was a big, big study drawn from two cohort studies of several thousand people in them. And they've got a new metric, which is new to me, this whole, they're calling it the working life expectancy, the WLE, which is kind of good from my point of view, I think, great, because we've always known about, you know, health expectancy, life expectancy, et cetera. Now they're actually using sleep disturbance as a predictor of working life expectancy. And they found that what we've known for a long time, like a few decades now, that severe sleep disturbance, like very little sleep, like less than an average of 6 hours, or very long sleep duration on average, like more than 12 hours on average, is associated with poorer health outcomes. But now the researchers are able to frame it in this new metric, as I said, the WLE, and they found that a significant reduction in working life expectancy compared in those people who had these really wide-ranging, very poor sleep or very little or very long sleep, compared to people with no sleep disturbances or really mid-range sleep duration.
That kind of makes sense, right? Maybe you're sleeping a really, really long time because you have a sleep disorder or you're sick in some way, or maybe you've got really poor sleep and you're feeling foggy and you can't concentrate at work. It's sort of not as much of a surprise as you might think.
Exactly. It's not, but what's the surprise or what's the good part about it is that they're actually specifically targeting sleep disturbance rather than and specifically your ability to stay in the workplace, because what it's building on what we've known for a little while now too is that this midlife range of people who are working, people who are, say, 50 to 65, the health that they have, and now specifically we can actually have even more evidence to say, look, get your sleep optimal for you. It doesn't have to be perfect, but get your sleep sorted. If it's really, really, really debilitating, don't put up with it, because not only is it going to maybe keep you might have to retire early, and that's all sorts of problems for yourself and your workplace, but you'll reduce in your later years, you'll have a reduced risk of chronic conditions, so heart health, lung health, dementia, obesity, type 2 diabetes and the like. So it's actually a really important piece of work for those listening who are still working and those people who work in like occupational health and safety, for instance, and bringing into the workplace really good discussions around, like, what's your sleep, asking about your sleep, what's it like, Do you know that you can get it sorted? Because there's a lot of people who don't even know there's a sleep field, believe it or not. Like, that people know there's sleep school for babies, but they don't know that there are sleep experts out there. They don't know of the Sleep Health Foundation, for instance, and our good resources. So it's important piece of research that we can now really harness for public awareness.
What kind of things are affecting people's sleep in midlife?
Well, our study from this year, the sort of Aussie sleep snapshots that was released in August.
Snapshots.
That would have been good though. Every year we find that stress and worry and unbalanced workloads is the number one factor of keeping Australians awake at night, their self-report at least. So we know that that's a problem. We know that people carrying weight, having aches and pains, having increased risk of snoring, unbalanced, so, you know, misuse of alcohol and other drugs, unbalanced amounts of caffeine, hormonal disruption, and they think that we all know about the sandwich generation, of course, of people in their midlife who've got often still dependent children, and increased caring responsibilities for elderly parents, and increased work responsibilities, more senior roles, etc. So there's a lot of what we call the midlife collision, that there's not only the health, sort of your health deteriorates to some extent. I mean, you know, even look at your hair and your wrinkles, and there's a, I don't like to call it deterioration, I just call it like it's a change. But what you say, your health is different to what it was when you were, say, 15. And you think about your sprinting across 100 metres when you were 15 and you're sprinting across 100 metres when you were 50s. Is different, and it's not necessarily a really bad thing, but there's a significant change, and our sleep is the same. It's just not as good as it used to be for most people.
So you mentioned the sandwich generation. Well, here with us is Sarah McDonald, host of the Club Sandwich podcast, all about finding yourself in this midlife squish. Sarah, you're sandwiched between caring for your elderly mum, your kids still live at home. How is your sleep?
It's not great.
The laugh says everything.
It's not great. It's not great. And I wonder whether I should sort of get one of those wearables and do it. But I actually did a sleep test recently where they attach all these electrodes to you. And unfortunately, I did it after I'd done a meditation weekend, which I thought would help my sleep. And so I had the best night's sleep I've had in about 15 years when I was attached. And I haven't got the results yet, but I think they're going to be okay. But I haven't slept well since.
Interesting. You got all your good sleep out, or it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. What do you reckon is going on, Sarah?
I said that to them. I said, did you put some, you know, sleeping tablets on those electrodes that seep through my skin? I think it was the meditation weekend. I mean, you talking about the sandwich generation there, I think 9 out of 10 feel burnout at some stage. And I think a report by Australian Seniors said 46% of us have sleep disturbances. And it's that constant whirring of your brain when you've got so many responsibilities going on at once. I must say I sleep a little bit better now since my mum's moved into aged care, because before she sold her home, every time it rained, I would sit bolt upright in bed and panic because my mum's roof used to leak occasionally. Mm. And I still wake up when it's heavy raining and I go, and then I go, oh no, it's okay, she's safe. So I'm going back to sleep easier now I know that she's in a safe place and she's being looked after than I did before. So I think it's that churning worry on our brain a lot.
Yeah, that really speaks to that kind of anxiety, that never switching off brain that a lot of people with a lot of responsibilities can relate to. I want to say women, but I'm sure there's plenty of men who find themselves in that place as well.
Yeah, there are. And I don't know, I shouldn't kind of gender sleep, but, you know, my husband goes good night and gets to sleep in about 8. Like, I swear to God, his head is still in the air and he's asleep and I'll lie there for an hour. So it is kind of frustrating that women tend to not sleep as well. I'm one of those people, I take a long time to go to sleep, like about an hour, hour and a half. And since I was probably in the sandwich generation, which has been 15 years now, but for the last 15 years, I would say I wake up a lot more often. And it's also when you have teenagers and they're out driving, you'll wake up when they come home. Oh, good, check their home. So you are sleeping, but it's not a deep, restful sleep that you need when you've got so much going on, I feel.
Well, you mentioned gender and sleep. Well, at least on the text line, there are some boys telling us that they're not sleeping great either, if that makes you feel any better, Sarah.
Brian... No, it doesn't. I don't want to share this.
Brian says, I'm now 67. I've noticed that in later years, I'm often awake for extended periods after getting up for a pee during the night. I don't worry about it too much because I figure that at least I'm still resting. I find deep breathing exercises and counting backwards from 1,000 by sevens to be helpful strategies for getting back to sleep. Brian, you're stressing me out. I don't know if I could actually do that. Dean says, I'm 64 and since about 60, I found it hard to sleep all night, say 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. I have to go to bed at midnight, but often wake 3 or 5 a.m. and then get an hour's sleep, which makes you feel terrible when you get up. Moira, it does sound like there's a pattern happening here. How much of this is sort of normal and don't worry about it? And how much of it is stuff that you can kind of go, there are interventions for this?
Yeah, really important. And first of all, too, that women are twice as likely to report insomnia. So it's not just Sarah, you know, trying to genderize it. It's the facts speak for themselves, too, that it is more, it's disproportionately women saying that they're not sleeping well. And I think it's important that, because there is a bit of, you know, like we're not going to be as good with our sleep as we were when we're younger, but it's really important to, I think the bottom line would be how you're coping during the day with your occupational functioning and your social functioning. So basically your quality of life. Like, are you able to function still, or are you having like unintentional naps, like really like falling asleep when you don't want to, particularly on the roads, but even in, like those sorts of things are like, if someone's had a near miss with that, that is not, that means you're really actually not having enough sleep. And you need to fairly urgently explore, you know, have that assessed. So I think talking to your GP, looking at the symptoms, because some people think, well, I don't know if I've got sleep apnea. I don't know what's normal limits of things. So Sleep Health Foundation website, at the very start, you can go in and actually look at your, like a symptom checker. You can actually, so that's a really important thing people have access to, or speak to your GP, or ask, even in remote parts of Australia, ask for a referral to like a telehealth for a person who's qualified as a medical sleep expert to actually get your sleep assessed. Most people won't need to do that. Most people can actually have a good idea of what's causing their sleep disturbance. And in someone like Sarah, who's got all these collisions going on, and myself included, to actually try and see if you can manage it. Like, and I manage it with keeping the rest of my life as healthy as I can. Like, I try and, you know, try as much as possible to be as healthy as I can. When I have sleep disturbance, I'm really good at catching, you know, having naps. I'm really good at trying not to panic about the poor nights I have. There's a whole lot of strategies that you can see on the Sleep Health Foundation website about that, about managing insomnia, et cetera, and knowing when to go to the doctor or not. Mm. So I think they're really important ones, because it's my job is to have this sleep health awareness, but also not triggering too much panic in people. And because it's really hard to know what's normal, isn't it? It's hard to know what should I put up with and what shouldn't I. But if you were walking around with a really sore ankle, like you could barely walk, and you didn't know there were physiotherapists or other things that could help, then I think that's the same with the sleep. If it's quite debilitating and really affecting your quality of life, please don't put up with it.
Moira, is there some sort of like low-hanging fruit of things that you find people often get wrong, or that often have like a big return on investment?
Yes, a really good return on investment is to know that waking is normal. So to, like, we all wake all through the night and go through different stages of light and deep sleep or wake periods. So try to reduce the temptation looking at the clock. So take away the clock, take away the phone in the bedroom is a really good value for money kind of intervention. And not aiming for 8 hours, not aiming for the person before that said, I don't sleep from 11 till 7 or whatever it was. It's like, either do I. I think knowing that we aim for 7 to 9 hours, but 6 to 10 is normal, and also you don't have to get it in one block. Maybe if you got 6 hours and then had a couple of half hour naps, if you're really debilitated, if you had the time, that would be really healthy sleep still. So those sorts of things, I think in a nutshell, are one of the best things. And of course the usual around, you know, alcohol, caffeine, trying to sort of manage what you're putting into your mouth as well, and the biggest one is managing workload, managing stress wherever possible, which is, I know it's really easy to say and not to do, but understanding what's affecting your sleep will be the best thing, because people might go into melatonin or magnesium or all sorts of things, but that may not be the root cause. So it's trying to address the root cause in your own mind. You're the person who's pretty expert in your life. What do you think is going on? Trying to address it on your own first, and then seeking some professional help.
I'm loving the text that you're sending me as well. Caroline says, I no longer have a problem with getting to sleep after discovering podcasts that are interesting enough but not too interesting. For example, astronomy podcasts. All the astronomy nerds out there crying at Caroline's backhanded compliment there. Another says, sleep expectations should self-adjust as we age. Early morning wakefulness is my creative zone. Clarity, inspiration, and imagination occur, followed by meditation, and finally sleep. Another says, my first yoga teacher always suggested that we need to release the day. So this is on the floor, not the bed. Review the day and let go of the things, achievements, etc. Acknowledge the good and the not so good, but let it go. Give yourself a pat on the back, then go to bed. Well, a pat on the back for both of you, Moira and Sarah. May you both have a great night's sleep tonight. Dr. Moira Junger is Chief Health Officer for the Sleep Health Foundation. Sarah McDonald is the host of the Club Sandwich podcast. And as it turns out, I've been talking a lot about sleep recently. If you liked this chat, scroll back through the Life Matters feed. Last Wednesday, I spoke to an evolutionary biologist about sleep in humans. It was fascinating. And my other podcast that you may know about is called What's That Rash? We did an episode on sleep all about smell and sleep with a very weird hack on how to get back to sleep if you wake in the middle of the night. I'm actually not going to give you any more spoilers. Go and listen to that. Search for What's That Rash on ABC Listen for that one. But right now, you're listening to Life Matters. Coming up next, the power of having a good whinge. You would not believe the morning I've had so far. Other drivers on the road, idiots, the lot of them. Then this morning, the coffee shop got my order wrong. Do I look like a matcha drinker to you? Also, I bumped my arm yesterday and it really hurt, but I don't even have a cool bruise to show for it. And I know these are small inconveniences, but come on, commiserating is kind of how we grease the wheels of conversation. Like, no matter how much I want my life and yours to be full of joy, there is so much more to milk out of a conversation with a bit of complaining in it than just a statement about how rosy everything is. Whinging even gets stuff done. I saw an SBS story this week where a campaigner called whinging a right. But do you agree? Where do you stand on having a whinge? When is it facilitating a social bond? And when does it turn you into the Eeyore of your friendship group? Tell me what you love to complain about. Bonus points if you hate complaining and you want to whinge to me about it. And here to have a bit of a whinge is Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne. He joins me fortnightly for a chat I call Social Studies. Dan, what is grinding your gears right now?
Ah, Tegan, I was going to say, maybe hopefully our segment, our chat can turn your day around.
I hope so.
Yeah, nothing much to complain about, but I do drive into the studio through the city in Melbourne and I have similar views of Melbourne drivers right now that you have of those up in Brisbane.
The thing about Brisbane drivers is if it's not raining right now, but if it starts to rain, no one remembers how to drive anymore.
Don't tell me you're going to start to talk about the weather to a Melburnian. Now we might have something to complain about.
Okay, so this is it. Like complaining about the weather, complaining about other drivers, it's sort of like part of the price of entry to have a conversation, especially that sort of small talk kind of conversation. Why is that?
Yeah, I guess it's some low stakes kind of sharing of grievances is one of the ways that we start conversations or bring ourselves together. Like it can be nice to say, you know, oh, I'm having a great day, everything's going really well, but that can be a bit off-putting to your interlocutor, where it's like, okay, great, okay. So I was going to tell you about, you know, the driver this morning or the problem with my coworkers, and now you've got that toxic positivity going on. So a little bit of low stakes complaining can bring us together, but it can also be a way to kind of test, like, am I right to be a bit annoyed about this? Is it something I should take further? And often our friends will say, yeah, you're right. I share your sense of frustration, but you probably don't need to go to the manager about this one. And it can be a good way to navigate our life with those around us to have a little bit of a complain.
One of the greatest feelings in the world is telling someone your grievances and them agreeing that you're in the right and that the other person's in the wrong.
And it's outrageous if they don't.
Exactly, exactly. So is this like a human kind of encoded thing, or is this a cultural thing that we've sort of learnt together?
So the psychologists will say that we have a bit of a negativity, a bias, all of us, part of human nature. But there is like a cultural overlay. Like there's definitely a sense that some cultures are more open to at least public complaining, and others, you know, keeping the peace and saving face is more important. But there's also an element of social change. So some people argue that there's this kind of mean world syndrome where the media and everything else has really learnt that negative emotions are how you get clicks and how you keep the conversation on social media going. So that the world shifted towards, I guess, a culture of whining about almost everything because it's good for engagement.
Is it something that's, I know that your research is very much about like intergenerational differences. Do we have different ideas about complaining, whinging, whatever you want to call it, across the generations in Australia?
There has been some research to look at whether kindness does differ across the generations, and also whether overall people are making more complaints. But it's really hard to pin down real meaningful differences because we also have a world where it's kind of become easier and harder for everyone to complain. So not just a particular age group, but everyone who's learned how to use the internet can now leave one stars or five stars if they're feeling generous all over the place. You can share your comments with a wider audience online. But on the other hand, even though the laws have probably also shifted to give us more rights as consumers in our day-to-day life to make complaints, getting your complaint to someone who can actually action it and who has power, say in a business, sometimes that's got a little bit harder. So it's not so much that one generation complains more than the other. And every generation that's got older seems to have complained about the younger generation complaining more, you know, when they haven't walked 5 miles to school in those shoes. But the way we complain and the opportunities we have to do it have probably shifted.
That's an interesting observation, this idea that it kind of alludes to the fact that complaining can and should be productive, that, you know, sometimes there is a time to call out something that's not right and try to fix it. Like whinging has a purpose beyond just social cohesion.
Yeah, and the difference between a legitimate complaint and an important complaint and then whinging or lack of resilience is in the eye of the beholder to some extent. And also some people in society have more power to decide what counts as a legitimate complaint. And if you look back over history, almost no improvement in society has come about without people complaining and then getting others to join in those complaints, and with some people who have power calling them whingers, at least at the beginning.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne, about the power of whinging. And I'm asking you what you love to whinge about. Linda says, when travelling with my partner and tween child, we put into place a time limit for whinging. We were allowed 5 minutes a day. It got so funny trying to complain nonstop for the allotted time. Ali says, whinging is a polite expression of rage. Have a private tanty and then others won't have to accept the projection of your rage. Whereas Bernie says, I cannot bear whinging. I think I'm a bit sensitive to it and steer the conversation in the other direction. I think about what you can do, amend your situation instead of whinging, or whinge silently to yourself. Because, Dan, yeah, there's got to be a limit. Otherwise, you're just a massive bummer to be around.
That's right. So when you share complaints with others, it can be about making change. And sometimes it can just be about, you know, commiseration, sharing with others a similar experience. And even when you can't change things, say at work, sharing the frustrations about what you can't change is fine. But we all also know that there are people who take that too far, or times when a culture develops that isn't positive for everyone, where it's just stuck in a kind of negative feedback loop. So there is a balance here. But like I said, it can be in the eye of the beholder. Like I find complaints to almost certainly be unreasonable and whinging if they're directed at, say, my teaching from my students. But then if it's about me having to wait too long for my pizza on a Friday night, then it's a sign that society is falling apart and something must be done.
So complaining is acceptable in all situations except for when it's directed at you.
Well, no, like we have had, as well as this kind of maybe shift towards a negativity bias, part of a kind of consumer culture or a business culture, say in the US, that was had sayings like all feedback is a gift, you know, we treat it as a gift. And I'm sure that's how you feel about all the comments from the callers and listeners you get about every segment you have. It's always a gift.
How dare you? I only ever get good feedback. Dan, thank you as always for chatting with me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne. And Jackie says, I love Kim's comment from Kath and Kim. Be quiet, Eponine Ray. It's mummy's turn. It's our go-to quip if a family member is having a whinge. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, earlier in the show, we spoke about a wish list for a renter's utopia. The ACTU is calling on the federal government to improve stability for long-term renters. Its plan includes more investment in public housing and minimum two-year lease terms. And you heard from Candy, who's been renting her whole life. She's now in her early 80s and has had to move every year or so since COVID. She loves the idea of longer-term leases because it would mean that she gets to enjoy the literal fruits of her labours in the garden.
Gardening is so important because it occupies your mind, occupies your body. It's so healthy. But when I put the seeds in there, in the garden or in the pot, I want to see them grow and I want to, you know, eat those vegetables, see those herbs, see those flowers, because I do it for everybody who walks past the garden. Mm. But the problem is when you're constantly moving, you're leaving the garden behind, and actually sometimes it improves the property so much that the landlord who's selling it gets more money because it looks so good, you know. And I have done that. I've improved properties so much just by renting them and looking after them and cleaning them and things like that, that they actually are valued higher than what they would have been if it had been in the condition it was when I moved into it. So, you know, I think really good tenants who are genuine should be respected more by anybody who, you know, wants to be a landlord. But I think social housing and community housing that Hal was talking about, long-term, forever, you know, so you can rent your forever home, just be there, clean the place, look after the place, protect the property, you know, and pay your rent quite genuinely, honestly, but you grow your garden because it's good for you and it's good for everybody.
So that was lifelong renter Candy talking to me about why greater stability would make a huge difference for her. I've also loved getting your texts on this. One says, as a renter who's moved so many times, my creativity and joy is dead because I keep having to leave a garden behind. No pets, can't hang art. Another says, I want this gardener as my tenant, please. Not enough respect for gardeners in our society. Well, if you'd like to go back and listen to that full chat, you can do that. Just search for Life Matters on ABC Listen. Maybe give the team a little bit of time to get that story up online, but you'll be able to listen to it later today. That's almost it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Beverly Wang is going to be with you tomorrow for Life Matters. She's going to be talking about what it means to have a good death. If you've got ideas about what you're hoping for your end of life, or you've seen it in your loved ones, give her a call after 9 a.m. tomorrow. Beverly Wang will be taking your calls. I will be back with you again on Monday. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.